of the upheaval in our world in recent weeks and months, we've all been forced into a period of reflection. And while the economic consequences for businesses in many sectors under lockdown have been harsh, a window of opportunity has opened. Businesses big and small have taken up the opportunity to speak frankly and directly to their customers and clients about exactly what they stand for, and have been given the flexibility to acknowledge the past while setting out their future. It's been an incredible time. Brands big and small have stepped up as leaders and a voice of reason, even as many have seen the rug pulled out from underneath them and sales and profits evaporate. We've come to see the importance of local businesses to our communities, and we found new ways to do business, thinking of new initiatives and products we may not have when 2020 began. This week, we'll again offer some guidance which might help spark your next idea, or maybe even rethink the way you approach work. You're listening to The Entrepreneurs with me, Daniel Bache. On this week's program, I speak to John O'Holt. He's an investor and the founder of London brand strategist Otherway. The agency not only helps to guide larger corporates, but at the same time puts its money where its mouth is by incubating new players and startups. We also meet Linda Grattan and Andrew Scott, co-authors of a brand new book called The New Long Life, who might have you rethinking how you view age and skills development. But first up, this week's opinion piece, which comes from Ariel Childs, the managing director of Wink Creative. Wink is Monocle's sister company. We share offices and ideas, of course, and Wink, in fact, helped to launch Monocle as a brand back in 2007. For two decades, Wink has been a leading creative agency in helping companies connect to their audience in various sectors, from aviation and automotive to hospitality, finance, media, technology, and much more. As you'll hear, if you're rethinking your company mission, you may also want to think about who your customers actually are. Here now is Ariel.
As the director for our branding agency, I have been working with my colleagues to help our clients plan for business success in the future. It takes knowing our clients deeply to come up with the right ideas. Every so often, I'm tempted by a newsletter headline from an advisory that makes me think they have a breakthrough idea that we have missed. I'm usually disappointed. I read a report from a reputable consultancy this weekend, setting out a 5-point plan to get back into business. After an entry on the importance of ensuring your staff feels safe, and then a graph on adaptive pricing structures, I was done. Call me simple, but this pandemic has been a shock to our global system, and a shock is just that, a jolt that shakes you up. A shakeup that demands that your business or organization reconsider its purpose, what you do, and how you do it. But first and foremost, you should understand who you do it for. We've been brought closer together, and in some cases, brands and businesses have used their communication effectively to deepen loyalty and build advocacy. But now is the time for brands to leverage this not just through messaging and talking to their audiences, but understanding them. To do that, you need a two-way conversation. The most important work that a brand or business can do right now is learn how the mindset of its audiences have changed. Now is the time to ask the right questions and listen to your clients and customers. Learn how your partners and suppliers are adapting. Hear how they feel and what they are thinking about now, and crucially, what they are looking for from their products and services. Insight into your audience and creating value for them will be the key to your rebound strategy.
Ariel Childs, Managing Director of Wink Creative here in London. My thanks to Ariel, and you can learn much more about their work and clients at winkcreative.com. Now, in some corners of the world, people are slowly returning to the office and their places of work. And much of the conversation for employers has been around how to keep people safe, as the need for physical distancing continues. At the same time, this rethink of the workplace comes amidst a wider conversation about the future of work. For more on that, I caught up with Linda Grattan and Andrew Scott, two leading thinkers on the topic and authors of the brand new book, The New Long Life, a framework for flourishing in a changing world. The book explores how technology and living longer lives are changing the idea of work and employment. As you'll hear, they argue society is failing to catch up.
Basically, we've got these two big trends. We're living longer and we're healthier for longer. Then, of course, we've got these extraordinary new technologies that are already starting to make an impact. And, you know, the question then is, how do we make the most of that? And I think, you know, for us, time and how we structure our life is a social convention. And we're currently working on models that are out of date. And so then the question is, we can sense a lot of social anxiety right now because, you know, the notion of a career for life, getting a pension just doesn't seem to work anymore, given how long people are living for. And given how disruptive we expect technology to be in the labor market. So there's lots of fear around these things. But our starting point is that, well, if you're living longer and you're healthier for longer, that should be good news. We've got these great smart machines, that should be good news. So let's step back and think, one, how do you prepare yourself for this? But at a deeper level, what do we want to get from this? Because, you know, longer, healthier life sounds a good thing to me. And then if we've got machines who could be more machine-like, that raises the option that we can actually be more human-like in some way. So that's the starting point of the book, rather than just looking at a dystopian view, which I understand where that comes from, because if we don't change, then we're heading along a path that doesn't look very appealing. But actually, these should be good things. And given we're smart enough to invent these machines, we should be smart enough to find a way to make them work for us as a society.
Let us hope so. We talk a lot about on this show about how there's no perfect time to start a business, and age and experience, of course, part of that as well. Linda, for years, it seems like we've been at this crossroads of the future of work and the threat or opportunity of artificial intelligence and advanced technologies, and how that impacts workers and jobs and the way we live, the way we are in our office. But what about those concerns viewed through the lens of this global pandemic, really? I mean, outside of factories and ticket booths and checkout counters, automation hasn't really taken over our workplaces. But now there are renewed concerns about people wanting to be together. Should they be together? I mean, obviously, your book just came out last week and it was well before this pandemic. But talk to me about some of the conversations you're having about these massive concerns for business leaders right now about how they're going to design their workplaces.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it, that we wrote the book pre-pandemic, but actually, you know, when you read The New Long Life, you'll see it was as if we wrote it during the pandemic. I mean, we absolutely have seen many of the trends that we talk about in the book absolutely accelerated, where we talk about automation. There will be more automation as firms move into recession. The first thing they're going to do is to think about how do we use a technology rather than people. We talked about the huge importance of upskilling and reskilling, which we still believe to be one of the most significant ways that government can intervene right now to really support not so much jobs, but support individuals to continue to grow and continue to have the right sort of skills. But also, by the way, we're seeing an acceleration in inequality, and that's something we talked about in the book as well. So much of what we talked about is accelerating, and there are some fundamental questions about how do we work in the future. What is an office? Why do we bother having an office? But also questions, I think, deeper questions, which I've explored quite a lot recently in various places, which is about how do we create innovation and creativity? You know, you sitting in your room, in mine, Andrew in his, we can sort of get stuff done, but can we really be creative? And I think for your listeners, particularly the monocle creatives, this must be a real worry for them.
You know, what worries me is that we're going to start to use technology because it's cheap or convenient rather than because it's good. And that is a really fundamental problem I think we've got in terms of how technology rolls out. And, you know, I think if you look at the focus of how we're developing technology, it's not really based around necessarily making our life better. And I think this is what this whole episode of COVID is going to bring to the fore. We can see the advantages, we can see the disadvantages. What worries me is that given the financial pressures that are going to follow from COVID, firms will just be keen to use technology to save costs. And that's going to be a real problem because we've got to use technology to augment things rather than to cut costs.
Linda, I wonder about the idea you write about aging better. And we speak a lot on this show about opportunity. Of course, there will be opportunities for business there. But I wonder about for the individual. You talk about stripping away the titles of millennial and baby boomer and things like that. But as skilled worker going forward, how can we personally think about how we present ourselves as a skilled individual or person, and where might we find opportunity?
Well, you know, Daniel, it's absolutely crucial that we move out of ageist language. Actually, one thing we describe in the book, The New Long Life, is that age is malleable. I mean, a relatively small proportion of how we age is down to our DNA. Much of it is to do with the choices we make about what we eat, about how we exercise, about the people we hang around, about how we think about our lives, you know, in terms of being positive. So we think that healthy aging is absolutely crucial. And that begins not, by the way, at the age of 65, my age, but it begins way before that, decades before that, in terms of how you prepare yourself to live a new long life. So aging is really important. Can we also have a quick push against stereotypes in terms of the generations? I know we love baby boomers, we love Gen X, Gen Y, the snowflake. There is no empirical evidence for any of these labels. You know, they're a marketing confetti. The truth is that at any age, the difference between you and other people of the same age is greater than between you and another age cohort. And so what that does, what those generational labels do, is it really stereotypes people. You know, I don't like, just because I'm 65, A, to be called a baby boomer, B, to be told I'm the same as everybody else, and C, to be told I don't know how to use technology. And that's really putting us into boxes. And Andrew and I are very keen that we open those boxes and let people be social pioneers at any age.
You talked about opportunities as well, Daniel. I think, you know, think about again about the entrepreneurial space. It's amazing how little understood the older market is. So one of the things you often find is everyone says, oh, the over 65 market. I mean, just imagine saying that about the under 35 market. And of course, the thing about aging, because of its sort of malleability, by which you mean the relationship between your chronological age and your psychological age and your sociological age with chronological age, is something that is variable, that people age very differently. And I think by and large, major firms have a real weakness here. They do not understand this market because they're looking at an over 65 market. And that goes wrong in two important ways. Because people are aging better, actually some of that over 65 market is just looking for things that anyone would be looking for. And secondly, because of the diversity, it's not as homogenous as you might think. So major firms really don't understand that. And I think that's going to be a huge advantage for startups, because I think some of the fastest growing firms we will see from supplying that market, because to be honest, it's the biggest emerging market there is. If you look at the demographics, just the number of people, and of course they tend to have the most income and the most wealth, because wealth increases as you get older. So it's a huge opportunity. But to do that, you've got to drop the focus on age and start thinking more about what do people want and think of them as humans. So I think there's also an opportunity in that as well.
Thank you both for your time, Linda and Andrew. This has been fascinating.
Thank you.
Linda Grattan and Andrew Scott. Their fascinating new book, The New Long Life, A Framework for Flourishing in a Changing World, is published by Bloomsbury and is available now. Next up on today's show, we meet Jono Holt, founder and CEO of London creative agency Otherway, which launched back in 2013. Jono started his career with ad firm Karmarama, but as you'll hear, wanted to do things a little differently. Otherway works with some incredible companies like Unilever, Strongbow, and London department store Fortnum & Mason. But the other hat they wear is as a partner and investor to some of the brands presented to them. They've helped to launch Spin Studio Cycle, the juice brand Moju, and also Farrer, the watch company we've also featured on this show, a company Jono co-founded. Here's our conversation, where Jono starts by telling me about his inspiration and why he wanted to get involved in helping brands to tell their story.
Brands like Airbnb and Warby Parker started emerging out of the US, and I started to look at them and think, wow, like, these are incredible. They're growing from nothing to everything super fast. They've got new business models. They've got a direct consumer proposition. Warby Parker were letting you try on glasses and send them back. They were partnering with Superman. They were donating eye tests. It became kind of quite clear that, like, advertising was just like a tiny part of this incredible brand story. So it was at that moment when I was thinking, okay, well, I want to do more stuff like that. I didn't have a kind of a product-led business idea at the time. So I said, okay, well, why don't I create a company that can help other brands just behave in more interesting ways and start to sort of follow this new set of rules that was getting laid out. And I guess that was the idea of Other Way, I guess, hence the name. And really, you know, today is the same as it was 7 years ago. We exist to make great brands with good people.
It sounds like you came onto this right around the time, as you point out, that people are really getting into these direct-to-consumer brands and really young companies that can speak directly to people, really, you know, for the first time. We'll come on to some of the brands you also do work with who are bigger established ones like Unilever and Heineken and Fortnum and Mason, obviously, which is basically a British heritage brand, you know, a few hundred years old. But listeners will also know you from brands that you've started, and that is Far, the watch company, and some of the other ones that you've invested in and helped set up. Hexar has been on this show, Butternut Box as well. Talk to me about the difference there in both investing in brands, setting them up, but also working for other companies too.
I mean, to answer it really simply, our world is really kind of split into two. So we began by focusing on those venture brands and really starting businesses that didn't exist. So taking everything from scratch, creating names, positioning them, designing them, branding them, building their websites, sometimes helping them design their product and then taking them to market. So that's really where we sort of cut our teeth. I think I was applying a lot of the skills that I'd learned in Karmarama and in the advertising world to new brands. So like the first one we did was Cycle, which was the spinning studio in London, where we're shareholders in that business as well. And yeah, it was really sort of the creation of businesses that we were sort of fascinated in. And obviously it was kind of good for the soul. We sort of loved creating these things. But I guess the better we got at it, the more interested the bigger brands became, because, you know, the Heinekens of the world were really interested in Lucky Saint, which was the sort of 0.5% beer that we created with the founder, Luke. And it's an incredible brand. And the big brands, yeah, look at it and think, like, why can't we behave by these sets of rules? Why can't we do the things that some of the younger businesses are doing? Why can't we be a little bit more agile? Why do we have to sort of play by the sort of the established rules? And I think increasingly over time, yeah, the better we've got at the venture stuff, the sort of the more interested or more interesting we've become to the bigger brands. So, I mean, the one for us that sort of really does stand out is Fortnum & Mason. Like you said, you know, we've been working with those guys for 6 years now and we love it. You know, that is an amazing legacy brand, but it's got innovation at the heart of everything they do and an amazing team of people within that business, and we've loved everything that we do with them. And actually, when you think about it, you know, they're a modern day D2C brand. You know, their hamper business is an incredible business, and they form a direct relationship with their customers. So yeah, there's not always that much difference between the sort of our two worlds. We spend a lot of time speaking to founders who want to kind of know about the big brands and sort of say, oh yeah, I want to do what Fevertree did. And then actually you end up speaking to Fevertree and they sort of saying, okay, well, we want to make sure we're kind of entrepreneurial and we stay kind of agile and we stay true to what got us here. So sometimes we're a bit of a conduit between the two.
And I'm so interested in the company setup as well, in how you get involved in new brands or help to create them, both, you know, taking an idea and helping the founders sort of bring that to market, create that product and put it out there. But also your, as you already pointed out, your shareholders and other companies as well. So there's sort of a split between investing and startups as well. How did that come about?
The main part of it has been that we've always been sort of fascinated in the business of brands. When I started Other Way, I really wanted to sort of get involved in the business and, you know, and hopefully share in some of the fortunes of the brands that we create. I think I've got two partners now, Stu and Ben, who are good friends, and they share the same beliefs, right? We love designing beautiful things. We love being involved with brands that are kind of full of purpose, but we deep down, we, you know, we want to make a difference and we want those brands to be successful, you know, for a number of reasons. And I think, you know, that's why we have always said that we're happy to put our money where our mouth is. We're happy to sort of back our own ideas. And yeah, I think it makes us different. I think, you know, there's loads of amazing agencies out there doing incredible things. And I think the ones that are willing to say, do you know what, we're happy to come in as partners with you because we truly believe in not only your kind of your ambition, but our skill sets to make this something really special. So yeah, that's what we've been doing from the start. And I think the biggest effect it's had on our business is the culture. So we have a group of really young, smart, talented people who, you know, are aware that we're creating ideas and we're designing campaigns and, you know, we're creating packaging for brands that we are invested in.
Talk to me about the approach to developing sort of brands and the pitch as well, because the range of companies that you work with is not in one sector. There's so much in there. The alcohol brands we've talked about. You've got Moju, the juice shots, Cycle, the spin studio, Hexar, the helmets, bicycle helmets. Just an incredible range of products and brands. So, do you approach them in the same way, or is everything sort of different?
I think it's amazing how much there is to learn from each brand, and actually how many similarities there are. I think we've had some like massive moments, I think, and those moments have created huge learnings for us. I think when we launched Button Up Box, it was actually off the back of a project that wasn't particularly successful, and we took away loads of learnings about kind of why something didn't work and why it didn't get picked up and why was it hard to sort of find and define the purpose. And out of those learnings, yeah, we really managed to create, I think in Button Up Box, Kev and Dave have created something really special. And that was, you know, that was a moment in time when we were sitting around going, okay, well, we know that, you know, the market is super crowded. We know we have to stand out. We know we need to play by a new set of rules. Kev and Dave were saying, you know, we want this to be really fun. You know, dog ownership is really fun. No one's kind of captured that yet. We want to be the people that do. And we're about to spend, you know, quite a bit of money in performance marketing. So we need a brand that works in really small formats in Instagram and Facebook. So we just had loads of learnings going into it, and I think that was sort of the moment in time when we launched, and obviously those guys had the ability to get it out there and grow it, and I think since then, you know, that sort of paved the way for, you know, three, four other brands that, you know, whatever category they are, they really do sort of stand out in the market. And I think that's part of the first issue is, you know, it's super noisy out there. Like, how do you land a new brand in these huge markets with loads of players that gets noticed?
And if people want to hear about Butternut Box specifically, it is episode 104 of Eureka. We'll share that as well. But I'm curious about work in this time for brands, Jono, because you guys normally are quite close to us where we are at Midori House. You're over in Primrose Hill with a sizable team, but right now everyone is apart. But there is still, I imagine, a lot of work for you guys to do for the companies you're invested in, for the brands that you work with. It's an interesting time. It's a sensitive time to sort of push product, but obviously the world needs to move forward a bit. So I wonder the conversations you've had sort of about that, about advertising and creating product. What's it been like with the team?
Yeah, well, as you say, yeah, there's 50 of us all sat around various parts of London at the moment, which is challenging, but also cool to see how quickly everyone's managed to pick it up and to adapt. So that's been certainly, even for our own brand and our own business, you know, we've had to kind of get our head around that. And then obviously we're sort of going into lots of conversations with, you know, whether that be with the sort of the venture brands or the established brands about what's the right thing to do. I think for us, in terms of kind of the venture brands, it's about, you know, we've always talked about, and I know everyone seems to talk about it, but it's true, right? Is what is the purpose of the brand in the world? And as the world has, you know, significantly changed in the last few weeks, you know, is that purpose still relevant? And for a lot of businesses, you know, and we're seeing them all over the place, like it is, you know, they can double down on it and go, do you know what? We are absolutely right. And what's happened is just, you know, has just sort of strengthened our proposition and kind of off we go. And then I think the world has changed so quickly that a number of brands are saying, actually, we're not right. We're not quite positioned in the right way. Our messaging doesn't feel like it's relevant. And that's not even kind of relevant now in the kind of the reaction to it. But, you know, it's going to be relevant the next, you know, few weeks, months and years to come as sort of mindsets have changed so quickly. So yeah, I think, you know, we're working with brands who are saying, okay, let's double down because, you know, we are right and we've got a strong purpose and let's go. Or we're working with brands to say, actually, let's just take a breath and realize what is right and where we should be positioned for the future. It's quite interesting because one of the conversations we're having at the moment is maybe it's time for brands just to look at themselves a little bit more and to be a little bit stricter on themselves. And maybe from a messaging point of view, let's not talk about the consumer. Let's not ask the consumer to do much. Let's concentrate on like what we're doing. What's our supply chain like? You know, what are our values? What is our purpose? Is everyone clear? Is everyone clear internally? And is everyone clear externally? And I think that's certainly the conversation we're having with a couple of brands, which is saying, look, it might be the case that you have to go out there and you have to change some things, and then you can tell people about the things that you've changed. So yeah, it's interesting times, but yeah, there's great opportunity for good if brands are kind of willing to sort of take the leap and listen.
You know, just talking about the near future and looking ahead, Jono, we talked about, you know, what brands are doing in this time to try to, you know, pause and reflect on who they are and where they want to go. But I wonder if you guys have started to have the conversation of, you know, what do we want to be involved in this time and going forward out of this whole pandemic? Has that changed your vision at all?
It's definitely focused our vision. I don't know whether it's changed it, but it definitely has focused it. You know, like all agency businesses, our destiny in some degree is in the hands of the brands that we work with. So whether that be our partnerships and the kind of the brand ventures that we create, or whether it be with the kind of the established brands that kind of want our help. We really want to work with good people, I guess. That's probably where it starts and finishes. Like, and what we define as good people are, you know, the type of people that just want to create positive change, and the type of people who are bringing products to the market that are excellent, you know, and the market truly needs. I think when we have conversations with people who are sat around the table and they're talking about unbelievable product, that is when we get super excited, because we know if we can add our skill set on top of theirs, then suddenly, you know, there's a potential for something super exciting to happen. So I mean, we're talking to two guys called Michael and Jacob at the moment. Michael is actually a professional footballer, and these guys are going to be launching the world's most sustainable running shoe in a few months' time. So when they came in with a shoe that's been, you know, made out of corn, and when they're talking about, you know, the product capabilities and the features that are essentially sitting at the heart of their running shoe, suddenly you're like, okay, this is really cool. And when you put that up against all the big names, you know, they're managing to deliver a product that is really going to blow, you know, the big names out the water. And those are the conversations that you kind of get home after a day at work and you're like, well, you're already at home because you're sat on Zoom. But those are the moments where you're like, yeah, this is what we want to do. So in terms of, you know, has it changed? I think it's just made us focus and made us be a little bit harder on ourselves and say, look, is this, you know, is this brand or is this product or are these people genuinely the things that we want to be doing in the future? And if they are, let's do it. And if not, let's pass and see what else is out there.
Very well said. And you'll have to let me know about the running shoe brand, because anyone that's bold enough to try and reinvent the running shoe, I want to talk to. So that is absolutely fascinating. Jono, thanks for your time. This has been really interesting.
No, thank you. Cheers, Dan.
Jono Holt, founder of Otherway. My thanks to all our guests this week and to Christy Evans, who mixed and edited this show. I'm Daniel Bache. Thank you so much for listening, and goodbye.